Well, hello there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast. Savvy Painter is the podcast for painters who know that mastering your craft is a lifelong venture. They understand that the hardest part is showing up every day, whether they're inspired or not, and that we're all in this together. For the past 3 years, the Savvy Painter Podcast has been sharing tips and techniques that you can use every day in your studio. And when you join the Savvy Painter email list now, you get a collection of inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Just go to savvypainter.com/subscribe to sign up for weekly emails and get your free PDF, Essential Tips for Artists. Each week, I interview established artists like Anne Gale, Scott Connery, Rebecca Crowell, and many other artists who are willing to open their studio doors, share their painting processes, and talk candidly about what it takes to consistently grow your skills. We get into the nitty-gritty of their daily studio practice, what tricks they play on themselves to avoid getting caught up in perfectionism, how to use flashcards as reminders to stay on track during long painting sessions, and other cool tactics to quiet the inner critic and continue moving towards excellence. The Savvy Painter Podcast is filled with artists who generously share their stories, and by sharing their stories, they show the rest of us that we are not alone. So join us with the Savvy Painter email list and get even more connected with weekly emails. Sign up now and you get essential tips for artists, the inspiring quotes and practical advice collected from years of Savvy Painter interviews. Go to savvypainter.com/subscribe. It's that easy. My guest this week on the Savvy Painter Podcast is the artist Constance Mallinson. In this episode, Constance shares her insights from 45 years of painting. We talk about the different phases of her painting career and how and why she transitioned between them. A common question I get from artists is about creating a body of work. It can seem daunting when you look at it from the beginning. At first, the questions are, what do I paint? And as artists try to answer this question, they're exploring, learning what fascinates them, and often discover new techniques and skills. The beauty of this phase is the unknowns. There's so many questions and so many potential paths to go down. That's also what scares a lot of artists. Should I be painting this or that? If I follow that impulse, will people see my work and think I'm inconsistent or that I don't have a style or a voice of my own? Constance talks about the spaces in between her bodies of work and the patience we need to allow our ideas to percolate. We talk about the time it takes to follow your vision and allow your work to tell you where it needs to go. We also talk about art movements and what it's like to be part of one. Later this year, at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, Constance will be part of a show that looks back on the pattern and decoration movement of the late 70s and early 80s. As usual, this is a wide-ranging conversation. So please enjoy this episode with Constance Mallinson. So Constance, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast. I've been looking forward to talking with you for a while, so I appreciate your time and being here.
My pleasure.
Would you tell me a little bit about how you got started as an artist? What made you decide to pursue this as your vocation?
Well, you know, I don't think there was any particular magic moment where it just came to me that the kind of dedication or the idea that one dedicates oneself to a studio practice is a really long-term and lifelong experience. I do think there are several factors that play into that, that begin very early. The love of making pictures and using various media, which for most artists begins very young. And as a young person, one tends to get approval from adults for doing so. So with that combination, you start to get feelings of accomplishment that tends to reinforce the process that this is something I want to stay with and be involved with. So by the time most artists get to high school, you're being encouraged to do this. And then for those of us who really get off on it, then, you know, one goes to college and usually declares an art major. And fortunately, you usually have no idea of the financial aspects of it. You know, you hear about starving artists, the cliches and so on. I think it's good that you don't know that when you decide to dedicate yourself to art, because probably that would discourage a lot of people.
I bet it does. Yeah, and I think probably parents are well aware of that cliche and try to nudge their children away from it.
It seems like
yes,
into being lawyers or doctors or whatever. Fortunately, my parents were very supportive, but this was back in the 60s, and they were happy that I was making art, but I don't think they ever fully understood what a lifetime commitment to it meant. You know, they didn't try to push me into anything else. So it's good and bad.
Who were some of the artists that you looked at when you were younger that inspired you?
So when I was really young, a very outdoorsy child, lived in suburban Washington, D.C., I wanted to be a naturalist when I grew up. But I also loved art and drawing and painting. And so I would do landscapes and watercolors and so forth of my natural surroundings. And at that point, I was very enamored with John James Audubon. But then as I grew older and began to seriously look at historical art, and we lived near the National Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., through my visits there, both with my family and on my own, I discovered the great artists of history. And that collection spanned medieval art to early 20th century. So I had quite an education just visiting. And of course, they had changing exhibitions and so forth. As a teenager, I really grew to love the Impressionists. They had a lot of Monets in the collection. They also had several other smaller museums in Washington, the Phillips Collection, which was wonderful. And for a very brief time, something called the Washington Museum of Modern Art, which was a very small building, kind of a townhouse. So as I was really beginning to be serious, I saw the work of the Washington color field painters. Gene Davis was one of those, Morris Lewis. So it was, I think, through those museums and institutions that something clicked, and I knew that this was really what I wanted to be involved with for my life, is making painting.
How has your art changed over the 45 years that you have been painting? What are some of the things that you have been fascinated by and explored during that time?
We're having a retrospective at this point. I think it'd be a super question. In that, I mentioned the Monets and the Impressionists and my early desire to be a naturalist. I would say that landscape has been a consistent theme throughout that 45 years. Now, that said, how does one interpret the landscape? There are thousands of ways to do that. So that in 1970, when I began really connecting with the contemporary art world, I was doing what could be termed as minimalist painting. But they were minimalist paintings about landscape space, and they had very subtle references to atmospheric or impressionistic landscape. So very soft pastel colors. Even though I was using geometry, I always saw these early paintings as a reflection on space with the picture a kind of pink and blue and very soft, cloudy, atmospheric space, a large scale superimposed with geometry. So you might see that as the human built space versus the natural space. So even while I was using the language of minimalist painting in 1970, I still saw those as a meditation on landscape.
It just reminds me of Turner and Monet, I think. It's been probably a good decade since I read this book, so it may, my memory of it may be foggy, but what I learned from that book, which I found fascinating, was that both of them, because of the time, especially Turner, some of those images that he made, it was as, you know, sublime as they feel and as sort of minimalistic, especially during that time, that his work kind of was, that it really was about humans, what we do to the landscape. And so much of those kind of foggy days was actually just incredible pollution from the paper factories that we looked at and we're like, oh my God, that's so beautiful. And when they really talk about what it was like to live during that time, it was massive pollution. And the Thames was just like, you know, would probably make you nauseous to smell what was being poured into it.
Well, yeah, and all those coal fires and so on. That was the famous London pea soup fog. Yeah, I don't know what book you're referring to, but Turner, of course, has always been a fave too.
I don't remember the title of it, but it was probably Turner and Monet or something. It was a direct comparison, like side-by-side comparison between both of their lives and, you know, kind of going through their career. So it'd probably be, if I'm just mentioning that in case I know somebody is going to email me and say, wait, what was that book? But it's probably called Turner and Monet or Monet and Turner.
So I have probably tended to make big changes in what I'm doing based on finishing what I think is the main focus of what I'm working on and not getting into repeating myself and trying new ways to look at this whole landscape nature idea. So from the minimalist work in the late 70s, early 80s, I became part of the pattern and decoration movement. The feminist-inspired art movement that was post-minimal and re-injected color, pattern, ornamentation, and overt references to more female-generated imagery and narrative. So it was an antidote to the reductivism of minimalism and was seen as, including women in the loop, there were very few prominent women minimalists. And so at that time, of course, the feminist art movement was really getting going. So this pattern and decoration movement was this attempt to, I don't know if you remember Miriam Shapiro, you know, she did these giant fan paintings that sort of embraced an orientalist decorative motif. This was to say that these kinds of images and the impulse to decorate, such as to embroider or to knit or to paint flowers or whatever it was, had been rejected by modernism, you know, sort of macho male painters as not important or not serious. So interestingly, I'm going to be in a show, a historical show this fall here in LA at the Museum of Contemporary Art that takes another look at this movement. So a number of my pieces from that era, from the very early 80s, are going to be included in that. So it's an overview and revisitation of that movement and what it meant.
That's fantastic. Congratulations. That's going to be fall 2019. I need to mention that just because sometimes people listen to this much later.
Okay, October to be.
October?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that's at October 2019 at MoCA in Los Angeles. That is so exciting that they're doing that.
Well, it is. And I have to say, it's a little strange to feel historical at this point. I said I've always been hysterical, but not historical. So anyway, the work at that point was kind of a bridge between the minimalist work that I described to you. And what I did was at that point, which would be 1979 through the early 80s, the landscape component of that work shifted from the minimalist work that I described to you to these patterned paintings and drawings that almost looked like they were woven, and they were constructed of millions of tiny little overlapping brushstrokes or pencil marks. So there was a layering process and a kind of meditative approach to building the surface of the painting. And the colors were very impressionistic again. And there was a real insistence on mark making, which was at the time with the feminist theory and so on, was seen as a sort of assertion of one's individuality or femaleness, was very overt on the surface of so the mark was very obvious. So the patterns that I chose were, I think, best described as a kind of abstracted landscape pattern. So it might be repetitions of chevrons or zigzags. Often I titled these pieces as The Forest, for example. So the colors would be based on natural greens and browns and that sort of thing. So that landscape connection was still there in this very abstract work.
I am not at all familiar with this movement, and I have to admit my complete ignorance of it. But at the same time, I'm so excited to be able to go dig into it. Like, I actually love it when somebody tells me about something that I didn't know at all, because now I get to go research it and dive into it. This sounds so fascinating. It sounds like, if I'm understanding it correctly, that all that mark making and patterning was somehow asserting themselves, the artist, into the work, whereas the minimalists were sort of trying to pull themselves out.
Yes. Well, if you think back to Greenberg, and it's all about the insistence on just the flat surface and the properties of paint. A painting was about paint. And that certainly played into the pattern paintings, but it encompassed so much more. So there was a purity element in minimalism that said there's no narrative here. Just about the materialism of paint. And feminists saw that as a way of that they were really denigrating women's experience, that was not seen in any way as serious or important. And I think this wonderful curator who's doing this project, the young woman, and you're saying that you weren't familiar with it, as many people aren't, the movement kind of quickly came and went, and without much recognition as to its importance. So, like a lot of curators, you know, she's looking for a way to find something historical and revisit it and rediscover it. And I mean, that's what great curatorial work, I think, is all about in terms of art history. And, you know, it's like, why did this get passed over so quickly? And there were male practitioners. I mean, there are going to be a number of men in the show. I don't know if you're familiar with Kim McConnell from San Diego. Have you heard of Holly Solomon Gallery in New York?
I've heard of it, yes.
She was the main New York gallery that showed this work. And in LA, it was not quite as big. I mean, I connected certainly with a number of women artists here who were excited about the ideas. There were a couple exhibitions that did attempt to show the work and define what was going on, but it didn't have the presence in LA that it did in New York, which is why I think it's kind of wonderful that she's doing it here, because there were just a few of us. So it feels good that, even though it's going to include a lot of New York people, that she's doing it in LA, because it was felt much more underground.
Yeah. I'm always curious about this. When there's a movement like that, are you aware at that time that you're part of a movement, or are you exploring something that you just were really interested in, and then later on you realize, hey, other people are doing it too. Let's look at this together.
It's a good question. What makes for changes in one's work? It's not overnight. You don't wake up one morning and say, oh, I saw that, I want to do that. Looking back, I would say that art making has always been about kind of an interfacing of the personal and the cultural. So I'm constantly evaluating where those two meet each other. I might be involved in a certain personal struggle in my work, formal issues that I'm trying to work out or solve, how I want to keep the making of those paintings really engaging and exciting. And I think when one gets into, for me, repetition, then that signals for me it's time to up my game or change it or see how I can tweak it a bit to keep it really interesting for me, because spending a long time in the studio, it's got to be really exciting and interesting. So that's where I think the cultural tends to influence and impinge on the personal. Is that making sense?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, I can absolutely understand that idea of you've sort of taken an idea as far as you can.
Right.
And, you know, at least for me, then I start exploring other, you know, I go through a moment of panic, honestly. I'm like, oh my God, now what do I do? But then you then you sort of get back into the like, okay, let's get curious about what's happening here and what are other things that I'm curious about. And it is absolutely not an overnight thing where you just suddenly decide, boom, I've got this idea and I'm going to do it. I mean, you may have that, but it takes time for that to evolve into something that's actually that you can,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong. I mean, in most of these transitional phases, there was probably a year or two of absolutely worthless work that got thrown out. But it was important work. It was experimental. It was helping me figure out the path forward. And so it takes a while to get that work up to the quality you're looking for. But, you know, in terms of also the pattern and decoration movement, you have to remember how impactful the feminist art movement was in the late 70s. This was tremendously life-changing for many of us. It said, yeah, you can actually have careers comparable to male artists and you can be taken seriously. So as women, there was a lot of support, a lot of cooperation, a lot of getting together and discussing the ideas. And that was invaluable to that particular time for me in making that change. The feminist art movement in LA was really strong. I came from DC in 1978, so I really didn't get in on the CalArts feminist phenom, but many of the women I knew here had. And so I was able to at least learn from them. So really, really important time for me.
Yeah, very important time. And I think there's a lot of discussion now about the equality of women in the arts, that the shows are predominantly male, that, you know, like it's still very much skewed to one side. But I think it's also important to remember how different it was in the 70s in terms of how women, you know, because it's easy just to feel like, oh, it was exactly the same as it is now. But I mean, see, I was born in 71, so I was too little to remember really any of it. But I know very basic things women were just, they were actively discouraged not to do, even though, you know, like it was either actively know you shouldn't do that or actively, you know, standing in their way to do it. What I'm thinking of is a couple of old broadcasts that now in the internet age are coming back up of people having discussions about women's role in society and whether, you know, and how damaging, how absolutely damaging it is for women to go to college and and not be home with the children. And even in terms of relationships, that a woman who's too well educated is really damaging the family unit. And so when you hear that now, like, you know, as somebody who came of age well after that, it's shocking to hear because you know, okay, things were bad. But when you hear the people recordings of those conversations, I have to say it was extremely shocking. And so there's really no comparison to what's happening today. So I'm just trying to like I'm trying to wrap my head around like those conversations and then trying to imagine myself or any woman in the 70s trying to be taken seriously.
Well, fortunately, there was quite a bit of consciousness raising. It might be comparable to now where you're really seeing artists of color getting quite a bit of attention, and the art world tends to be somewhat ahead of culture at large. In fact, a friend of mine, Maren Hassinger, who I've known for years from LA, she's now in New York, but she just got a wonderful write-up in Art Forum recently, and we were both just laughing, you know, like, finally it happened. But part of my generation and the frustrations, but I just have to say, there's no comparison now. I mean, there are so many more opportunities for women, and they're not really questioned the way they used to be. I mean, the only time I felt that it was really a problem was when I had my two daughters. One was born in 87, the other in 91. That's when I think the sexism reared its ugly head again, and there was this perception that women artists who had children were giving up, not really serious. That's what they were going to be doing for the next 25 years, and we can write them off. And I had a couple male artists, ironically artists who I had written reviews for. I also write criticism. In Art Magazine, come up to me and say the most toxic put downs of me when my children were small. Of course, I never stopped making art or painting, but a lot of things all of a sudden seemed unavailable to me just because of that really obnoxious stereotype that women with children are not interested or not capable of making good art. That was something I had to overcome. I mean, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger, of course, more determined. You're just so hell-bent on getting that studio time in, probably more than when they're grown up and gone away.
I've heard that, you know, so I ask this question a lot because I love to talk about this subject because I think, you know, then it was sort of like you gave up on your art career. And now I think it's sort of artists doing it to themselves, like thinking, oh, if I have children, I won't be taken seriously. And what I'm really fascinated by is because I'm, you know, I asked so many questions about this, and what I see is kind of what you just alluded to, is that when someone becomes a parent, male or female, their studio time becomes so precious that they become way more efficient than they ever were before because they have to do it between naps or, you know, feedings or later on, like taking them to school and back and all this stuff, or kindergarten where they're only gone for a couple hours every day. Did you find that to be true also?
Yes, absolutely. I think that you become very, very determined, very organized, very deliberate. And, you know, of course, the wonderful thing is, you know, your children benefit so much from seeing that. They enjoyed coming in and talking about what I was working on, and I could engage them in really interesting ways. And my older daughter is also an artist. She's an animator, not a painter. She said she didn't like to get her hands dirty, but and actually we collaborated on a project a couple of years ago. I was selected to do a metro station, so I did 24 artworks for one of the LA metro stations. It was digital, and since I'm a painter, I have to say my digital skills were pretty minimal, if next to nothing. So I was able to collaborate with my daughter on that, and it was absolutely the most fun I've ever had. I mean, it was really, really great. She was terrific. So who would have ever guessed in those frantic early years when you're trying to work in your studio time and that someday you would be collaborating with the very same creature that threatens to take your time away? And yes, I mean, I think, if you're not going to make art, if you're not serious about it, then you'll find an excuse. But if you are serious about it, wild horses can't drag you away from it. And this is what I hear from most women artists who had children. Sadly, I think a lot of my peers didn't have children because they were afraid of that, you know, that it would just sap their time and, you know, energy and all that. I have to say, I look at my peers who didn't have children, and I don't see any difference in their success rate. So it goes to show, you know, it's really about, if you're determined to do something, nothing can really keep you from that. So I think it's a mistake to think that you'll get so much further ahead if you don't have a family. That just wasn't the case for me. But there's some gaps in my resume, for sure, but I have no regrets.
What are you working on now? I would love to hear about what's happening these days in your studio.
From the pattern and decoration, I stayed with that for quite some time, and then I really did become pretty tired of drawing little marks on thousands and thousands of layers, little marks on on canvas, and I decided to return to figuration. Fortunately, didn't have a problem with those skills. I mean, you know, to me, they were kind of interchangeable. So I returned to making figurative landscape works, but I took the whole patterning idea and I created these epic scaled panoramic landscapes, and I'm talking 18, 20 foot long landscapes, which I constructed from thousands of appropriated photographs. So now we're talking 90s through early 2000s. If you think of postcards, National Geographic, Sierra Club calendars, and all this, I wove those together into these very intricate composite or collage-like epic landscapes. So I did those for quite a while. Again, you know, all this work has been very labor-intensive, so there must be something in me that needs to devote a lot of time.
Mm-hmm. Very detail-oriented.
By 2008, I had it with working from photographs, having painted literally thousands of photo images connecting to one another in these big landscapes. And I decided it was time to go back to observation, to actually putting something beside a photograph in front of me and working from actual observation. I do a lot of walking. And that's sort of going to get us to my current work. But I walk every day for about an hour through LA, through my neighborhood primarily. And I started picking up things on my walk. And the first things that I picked up were natural materials like tree branches and leaves and twigs and that kind of thing. See, this gets back to the whole naturalist thing from when I was 5 years old. I began constructing these sort of tableaus and images from this natural detritus. Most of it was rotting and decayed material. So I would construct human-sized figures from these tree trunks and gnarled stumps and anything I could find, really. So I don't know, are you familiar with the 16th century painter Archimboldo, who made the heads out of fruits? And I know you've
seen. Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So it was kind of a play on that, but I was making full-size human scale figures from these various natural materials. So did that for a number of years, and everything was decaying and rotting. And so I saw those as a kind of reflection on the human interface with the natural world and how we're all decaying. And, you know, we all have that possibility. And so more recently, from, say, 2010 to the present, maybe 2012, I started collecting human-made detritus instead of just the natural decaying twigs. So everything that I found on the street during my walks. So this would include little tiny plastic fragments, everything that people throw away. And it's all out there on the street, spilling out people's trash cans. So the most recent work are these gigantic still lifes, and I'm saying, you know, 14 foot by 5 foot still lifes that represent these accumulations of these objects that I'm finding and bringing home, and the vast array of what they are. I mean, everything from deformed Coke bottles to, I can't even begin to catalog the stuff that I find. Brand new things that people just throw out. Stuff that's been run over by cars. Toys. People that give their kids toys that they play with for a month and then it's thrown away. And so all these kinds of things are retrieved. Starbucks cups, fast food packaging, beauty products, print materials. Sports gear, huge amount of sports gear.
Wow. So this is, I mean, it just sounds like a combination of everything that you would, that would naturally be blown around on the street. And then the things that you find next to the garbage bin on trash day.
Absolutely. There's, as I say, it's a extremely diverse cross-section of our culture that's represented. The objects really become signifiers, of course, once they're put into these big still lives. I don't know if you got the images I sent you.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. I see a certain affinity with that still life painting from the 16th century, you know, where they piled up their pearls and their lemons and their skulls and books and things that they valued. The Dutch Golden Age of still life was the beginning of capitalism as we know it today, where they had colonies, they had trade, and vast fortunes were made. So I'm seeing quite a bit of similarities between that stage of history and our late stage capitalism. However, the Dutch, I think, really valued their objects, whereas we don't. We value them for 5 minutes and then pull them out. So, of course, there's a strong environmental aspect to this work, because I'm also interweaving the natural detritus in with these objects. So there's this kind of a melancholic reflection on the state of consumer capitalism right now and where we're going, but also a reflection on painting's rich connection to the depiction of objects. And everything is very painstakingly represented. So there's takes a lot of time to show the actual beauty of many of these objects. And if you stop and pick up a sprite can and study it in the light, it's incredibly beautiful. It's picking up all these greens and silvers and light reflections. I really, as a painter, you know, I'm caught between the abundance and beauty of these objects that we create and the downside of that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's so fascinating to me, just this idea that we are, you know, you compared it to the Dutch and, you know, obviously it was so much more difficult to get these things that they collected. And so this idea that these still lifes represented, you know, they were really kind of showing off their wealth in a way. And now we dispose of them. And that's what's really struck me about your current work, the work that I've seen, is that it's taking something that we discard and don't even look at and sort of saying, no, here, really look at this.
Well, it's a different way of showing off our wealth. It is kind of the same thing.
We're so wealthy, we can take this and just throw it away.
Oh, we can use it once, give it to our kid, and let him play with it till he's tired of it. And I mean, I still have my dolls that I played with because we only had a few and they were made to last. And some of the arms and legs are missing, but I love those dolls and I see how beautifully they were made. But we didn't have that many. You know, we got for Christmas and we played with it forever and ever. But now I pull toys out of the top of people's garbage cans that look like they've never been used. They don't even bother to take them to the Goodwill. So this is a different kind of flaunting of our wealth and our abundance from the Dutch. Obviously, if they had to go all the way to the West Indies to get a product, or to the Middle East to get a lemon, they were going to value it quite a bit more. But at the same time, it's about wealth showing off what we have. And so there are some similarities. And also in terms of patronage and painting, glorifying the wealthy patrons and so on. You could certainly make that analogy with art today. It's interesting to make those comparisons for me. So the landscape has morphed through all these various phases, but I have to say the consistency is my interest in nature and the natural world, and of course its dramatic changes since I was a child and where we're going with it now. So lots of concern, lots of worry, lots of feeling I need to tell that story.
Yeah. From this perspective, it's just so interesting to be able to look back and find that common thread. But I imagine there were points when, you know, I mean, hindsight is, of course, always 20/20, and you've had the time to reflect and think about some of these stages that your work has taken, because we can look back and sort of assess what happened. I think the impression that some people get is that you always knew that was going to happen, you know, that you always knew these paintings were going to come out and evolve into a body of work. And it was so refreshing to hear you talk about, you know, that you briefly mentioned it, but, you know, between those bodies of work, when you were following a thread or looking for your next step, that there were years of trying something, wiping it out, trying something, throwing it away. And I wonder if you could talk about those kind of in between periods, if you can recall them, and sort of just sort of as a, I say that because we tend to block those things out of like, oh, that was really hard, I'm going to like not think about that.
Well, I have PTSD about it. So
yes. I think it's like parents too, like women forgetting how painful childbirth actually was, because if I think they remembered that, you know, nobody would have more than one child.
you know, I suppose you could look at just about everything in life as a transition. I think it's our tendency to value the finished product more than the transition. I think we need to, and perhaps this is what you're getting at, we need to also value those in-between moments, those extremely productive and thoughtful and soul-searching moments where we're intensely looking at something, we're intensely searching, whether that's the scientist in her lab or the artist searching for new form. That's critical to the process. But, you know, I'm guilty as anybody else. I said I threw away most of the work in those transitional periods. Maybe that's wrong. Maybe that work should be seen and we should start to value that more. We're not there as a culture. We want nice finished product. We want everything packaged and branded.
And the overnight success and the effortless talent muse came and visited you in your studio and waved her magic wand and right. Voila.
Yes, exactly. But the struggling that goes on in between phases is really important. Now, just talking to you, I'm regretting not keeping some of that, just to look back and say, oh, this is where something was really starting to happen. So who knows, maybe what time I have left, I'll reconsider all of that. And I'm actually making, I'm not shifting into something. I would say I'm really expanding my practice to do anything I want. I came out of the, again, in the 70s, the idea was that you quickly branded yourself to a certain approach, whether that was Robert Ryman doing little splotches of white paint on a piece of vellum or something, and you just did over and over and over again, or if you were Morris Lewis, you did your stain paintings forever. And so the idea was that you would create your artistic persona based on one thing. That was your entree into the art market, because collectors, museums would say, oh, we just bought a fill in the blank. And you would immediately know what they were talking about.
You're painting to make it easy for people at cocktail parties to
exactly.
Give the 2-second version of what they just bought.
So that has died hard, but now I'm feeling a tremendous sense of freedom. And for example, just this last week, I had been at an opening, and a lot of my female friends were complaining, it's so hard, we can't get galleries. Just, you know, something's never changed. But so I went home, and it makes me laugh to think I did this. I had a recent Art in America magazine, and do you get the magazine?
Yes, I know the magazine, but I don't get it anymore.
The cover of it was a picture of a large head of Andy Warhol. And the article in the magazine was sort of a relook at Warhol's career and so on. So I took some acetone and I wiped out the Andy Warhol picture and I painted on the magazine cover a self-portrait. And so I posted it on Instagram. And what a brouhaha.
Oh, that's so arrogant of you, Constance. How dare you?
It was meant as a kind of a feminist gesture, but also a response to all my friends complaining. And I thought, okay, well, let's just have some fun with this. I'm just going to put myself on an art magazine cover. Well, of course, 90% of the people thought it was real, and thought I had finally arrived and had my picture on the cover of Art in America, even though I said on the Instagram post that it was a painting on the cover. And it was in the spirit of Rauschenberg's Erased de Kooning. Do you know that
mm-hmm,
painting?
Mm-hmm.
I was inspired by that. And it was just a fun thing. So now it's kind of ballooning into something beyond my control, but I used that to illustrate this idea that I'm just going to do whatever I want to. And I'm still doing my giant still lifes, but they take a long time to do. I mean, I spend 6 to 8 months on one painting.
Oh, that seems fast to me, given their size and the detail that you put in them.
Yeah, it just takes a long time to make these. So in the interim, while I'm waiting for paint to dry and whatnot, I'll do small pieces. And I actually have done a whole series of these self-portraits on found items, we'll call them. I did one recently that was in a political art show. I found a clear plastic bag, maybe 20 by 28 inches, something like that. And on the inside of the bag, I painted my self-portrait. And I titled it Self-Portrait Crying Inside a Plastic Bag. So I'm concurrent to the giant still lifes, I'm actually creating these pieces on the items themselves that carry an environmental message as well.
Oh, I love it.
My practice is kind of opening up in ways, of course, I never would have expected, but at the same time, I feel free from this whole idea of having to paint the same painting over and over and over again in order to create market presence or whatever. I just don't care anymore. So I'm having a good time.
It's so refreshing though, Constance. I mean, it's, you know, what's funny is I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine. She's not, I was about to say she's not even an artist, but I feel like there's this undercurrent right now or something of, because I've been talking to my husband about the same time. It's like, why do we censor ourselves? Why do we like not do what we want to do? And my friend said to me the other day that one of the things on her bucket year was to live 2019 only doing the things that she really wants to do, like just basically not caring about any, sounds so selfish, not caring about anyone or anything else, and just doing everything the way she thinks it should be done, kind of like as her mission for the year. And in terms of art, I'm so excited by what you're talking about right now. I mean, you were just saying like something that I said made you feel like you shouldn't, you wish you hadn't thrown those paintings away or that you'll keep the transition ones. And I'm just sitting here thinking like, how unspeakably liberating is it to just not care what people think about your paintings and go on any tangent?
And of course, ironically, there's a huge paradox in this, because the minute you don't care, other people start caring. Just as I say, as a humorous response to everyone complaining that they're not getting their 10 minutes of glory. And I said, okay, well, here's 15 minutes of glory on Instagram. Dig it. But, you know, there's also something, I don't know if you're reading these essays lately. I just turned 70 not too long ago, about the older women in Hollywood, Glenn Close and, you know, Maggie Smith, these older women actresses, saying, you know, this is the real flowering of their careers. And, you know, I think there's something about being a 70-year-old where you just arrive at this point that we're talking about, where I'm just going to do what I want to do and let the chips fall where they may. And I don't need to play to anybody's conception of what I should be at this point. It's tremendously liberating. And, you know, I feel like maybe some of my best work is going to come out of this.
I think it will.
And so we'll see. And, you know, with a lot of aging boomers out there, I think you may see a lot more of this. But you should encourage your friend to write a journal or, you know, create some documentation of this 2019 experiment. Sounds really great.
Yeah. So interesting how difficult it is, because it sounds like, well, that's obvious. Why wouldn't you just do that? But the conversation came up because I was talking with her about, you know, the tendency for people, especially women, to be people pleasers and to just, you know, kind of say like, oh, let's make sure you're okay before I'm okay. And I started really paying attention to it. And it's default. It is without thinking things like, where do you want to go to lunch? I don't know. Where do you want to go to lunch? And we're trying to like figure out like, what do you want for lunch? And it's kind of like, no, I want this.
Yeah, well, it's great. Let's just say I'm really enjoying this phase of my artistic life.
I love it. I love it. And I'm so excited to see where it goes. I'm just like going to be stalking you on Instagram.
Yeah, we have to connect on Instagram. So, but, you know, as a consequence, I think one of your questions was, you know, what's your dream project, or, you know, if money was no object, and, you know, what would you do if you could just completely kick it and do your project of your dream? You know, right now I'm ruminating on, I also do a lot of photographs while I'm doing my walks. So a lot of weird stuff out there. And, you know, it might be a mud puddle with something in it. It might be a crumbling structure. It might be, you know, whatever I encounter in my walk. So my dream project would be some sort of large scale installation where I can actually incorporate these different media. So photographs kind of interwoven with painting and objects. Talk about an in-between at the moment. I haven't quite got it, how I'm going to do that. But I've done a few sort of maquettes to see if something like this might work. But again, you know, why do these mediums have to be, and less you're seeing this, but you're a painter, so you only paint. You know, you don't make objects, or you don't do photography. And you certainly don't mix them together. And it's all part of the, you know, we're all just sort of beholden to the art market. And that's what dictates that, not your personal curiosity about what something's going to look like. And that's what feels liberating, is to just say, well, look, I'm not Jeff Koons. I don't have to worry about my market. You know, I'm just going to make whatever interests me, and so be it. That's what I want to do. And but of course, you know, if you are a branded artist, you have to make 10,000 of something so the collectors in Dubai can get it as much as the collectors in Hong Kong. So it's not a big worry for me. Yeah, dream project would be to interweave those different mediums that all deal with the subjects I've been talking.
Actually, I think I'm going to change that question after this conversation. I think I'm going to make it. I think the question is going to be, what would you do if you didn't censor yourself and you didn't consider the market and you didn't consider your brand and you didn't consider how it would be received? What would you do?
That's awesome. That's got to be put in the the questions now.
Yep, that's going to replace all the other ones.
Well, yeah, because it is restrictive. People are so tied into their marketability, and which, you know, there's so many myths that go along with that, because there are many artists who try to come up with a marketable product and really don't succeed with it. So why you know, subject yourself to that? And then you look at an artist like Mike Kelly, who I think really started that whole idea of subverting the marketing system by creating installations with dirty stuffed animals he picked up at the Salvation Army and having people buy them for $500,000. That was his vision. That's what he wanted to do. And he was also rewarded greatly for that. He was a disruptor, if you want to put it that way. But that, you know, I think that gave permission to other artists to say, you know, you can just do whatever you want. And it may or may not be financially rewarded, but you don't have any control over that.
Very good. Constance, this has been a wonderful conversation. I enjoyed it so much. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you for sharing yourself. And
so I didn't get to tell you about my favorite book.
We might have to do a part two.
That's a good question.
Okay, that'll be the last question then, because it's completely selfish on my part. I love books. So what book do you recommend I read?
Well, of course, I don't have favorites, but books that really feed me and nurture me, that bear reading over and over and over again. And a book that really does that for me is Simon Schama's Landscape and Memory. Do you know that?
I've not read it.
It came out about 15 years ago, I guess, where he goes through the history of landscape painting and makes cultural connections with it. It's very dense reading, but very profound. And of course, he's such a brilliant writer. It's historical writing, but done in a very literary way. So I would highly recommend that. And for painters, another book that I really was taken with was T.J. Clark's The Site of Death. He's an art historian. He spent 1 year going to the Getty Museum here to sit in front of one painting. And he went every day.
Wow.
And the painting was a Poussin, but he felt that was the way he could truly understand this painting. And I thought, how many painters would do that? Would go and spend that kind of focused, concentrated time with one painting.
Every single day he went to the Getty and he sat in front of the exact same painting?
Yes, and then he'd go back and write ideas and observations about the painting, and this is the way he really got to understand it and know it. Those are two really great books for painters, especially painters involved in landscape, to rethink it, to inspire, you know. Thank you for listening to me.
You are more than welcome. Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter podcast with Constance Mallinson. Thank you so much to Constance for sharing her story and to Marie Thibault for introducing us. Go to savvypainter.com and click on the podcast tab. You'll find show notes there, information on the artist Constance mentioned, along with examples of her work and links to connect with her. Once again, I'd like to give a big thanks and gratitude to some very special people who make this podcast possible. Thank you so much to Antoine Renault, Diane McGee, Robert Talbert, Susan Zeftin-Kuhn, Jamie Campbell, Robert Doucette, Tracy Lee Morgan, Gregory Meisner, Deb Cook Shapiro, Kim Weaver, Denise Klitzy, Kelly Berg, Rudolph Harris, Pat Oxley, Jill Opelka, Stephanie Drotti, Kathleen Speranza, Julia Patterson, Andy Dobie, Raquel Kramer, and Elizabeth Pinson. Big or small, your contribution matters, and the Savvy Painter podcast would not exist without you. Thank you so much for your support. Lastly, just a quick reminder that Savvy Painter will now be every other week. So until next time, this is Antrese Wood with the Savvy Painter podcast. Thanks so much for listening.